One day before our special on socialism that you're going to be able to find everywhere, that's tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern. You don't want to miss it. Socialism, a warning from the dead. We ask that you come with an open mind and you really, really pay attention to what we're going to share with you tomorrow, something that the rest of the media will not share. And it kind of ties into some of the news that was breaking today about Venezuela. We have an update during the show from Venezuela on what is actually going on there. Also, John Solomon is with us to talk about how they did find collusion. He and his reporting has found collusion, not with the Trump administration, but with the Obama administration. Wait until he lays this story out for you. It's pretty remarkable. We also look at Joe Biden's new speech impediment, which is kind of disturbing. And in what I would think is one of the highlights of the show, Stu breaks down the Clarence Thomas and Biden argument. They are changing our history in real time. And it's really, really important and good as well.
And don't forget, tomorrow night, Wednesday night, May 1st, May Day, is the date of the special that we're airing called Socialism.
What a coincidence!
Socialism, a message from the dead. How did socialists turn a capitalist country in just 3 years to socialism? Going back, looking at how it happened then and how they're attempting the same thing right now. It is an incredible look at history and also, unfortunately, our present. Socialism, a message from the dead. It's available for free. You don't have to be a subscriber for this, though we would encourage you to do so at blazetv.com/Glenn with the promo code Glenn. However, watch it for free. It's on YouTube, Facebook. It's going to be everywhere. You're not going to be able to avoid it. It's tomorrow night, May 1st, May Day. Socialism, a message from the dead.
That's all on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
I saw some video today that I thought was a little disturbing, and not that he is going senile or anything like that. He is just, if I were working for Biden, I would be concerned a little bit.
Yeah, you think? Maybe a little bit on this?
About a speech that he gave yesterday where he was... He was slurring his words a bit, and he's starting to sound like a very old man. Listen to this.
I want to thank Rich Fitzgerald, the county executive, Allegheny County executive, for being here. And all my time in public life, once I've gotten involved, the country wasn't built by Wall Street bankers, CEOs, and hedge fund managers. If the enterprise hits hard times, everybody took a hit. Union workers, the UAW, took incredible cuts in their future and their pensions and the less to get GM working. They also got that last year and try to cut wages or freeze wages for their people. Right today, the same is happening in big hospital systems. I think we have to rethink how we define what constitutes a successful economy. Folks in America don't think their children are going to have the same standard of living they had. How can a person's dignity be maintained? Why they do that? It means investing much more in medical research to conquer devastating diseases like cancer and addiction and Alzheimer's. So God bless you all and may God protect our troops.
Now, this was in front of the Teamsters yesterday in Pittsburgh. And again, I don't think he's senile or anything else, but he is starting to slur his words like my grandfather used to. And that doesn't instill confidence.
Yeah, you hit a wall there maybe? Where it's just not happening. Here's the issue with Joe Biden is he's not a deliberate speaker, right? He's not a professor where he sits back and is speaking in marked tones. You know, that's not what he does. He is a conversational guy. He tries to sound like everything he says is off the top of his head. And that's been part of the charm, I guess, of Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. If you are an archaeologist and can find the charm, that's kind of it, right? He's conversational. He kind of goes that way. That gets harder and harder, I think, as you get older. And if he's having issues with this, he's going to have to change his style. You know, he
and
really
that
is.
Will be death to him.
Yeah.
That'll really be death.
That's going to be tough. I mean, look, it's his first speech in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if you chalk this one up to he's a little rusty. You can make that argument. You know, I mean, I'm just
maybe he was just tired or whatever. But I were on his staff, I would be concerned. You can't pile speech after speech after speech up like this.
No. Well, and Glenn, if this is your campaign launch, you can't be tired. This is not a I'm tired option.
Especially after you're running with against Trump. Trump is a machine.
He has unlimited energy when it comes to this stuff.
Right.
And that was probably the most amazing thing about 2016. I mean, the guy ran. How old is he? 72?
72 years old. And he's not in shape. It's not like the guy's worked out his whole life.
No, he eats like I do. He's at McDonald's every day.
Right. And he is just a machine. He just doesn't slow down.
I remember we did one weekend in Iowa last year, or last election. Mm-hmm. Do you remember this? And we're just going around. You get off the plane, you go to a car, you drive for 45 minutes, you get out of the car, you're whisked around, you don't know where you're going, you know, especially like, and I'm not, you know, Glenn's the one making the speeches. I'm just kind of standing there behind and watching. But you know, you're meeting a bunch of people for the first time, and you have to be on in every one of these moments because, you know, these are important interactions you're having, mm-hmm. or at least you think they are. And then, it's the second it's done, you're running to the car, it's cold, you're driving to another place an hour and a half away to do essentially the same speech to a different group of people where you have the same interactions, and you're doing this. We did this for a weekend and I wanted to kill myself. I can't even imagine what it's like to do that every single weekend. Now, Trump was smart, I think, in the way that he sort of redesigned that process. His process is, I got my big jet with my name on the side, I land, I talk, I leave. And I think that was part of this, you know, brilliance of the way he approached it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everyone else was going door to door and meeting nine people at a place, you know, where they're serving eggs and bacon. He's going to a big venue. And so he had less appearances, but still talked to as many or more people. And that's a smart way to do it. And maybe Biden can pull that off. But in a field of 20, there's no celebrities in it. You know, Biden's not
and
a celebrity.
It's
he's
not
a candidate.
Like, it's not like the second run for Obama. Remember, Obama the first time ran like Donald Trump,
yep.
had huge venues and, you know, could fill stadiums and arenas. The second time, if you remember, he couldn't fill arenas. Donald Trump is still filling arenas. So he's still running with the same kind of electricity in the air, where that didn't happen for Barack Obama.
Yeah, and Trump has the ability, too, that I don't think Biden has, in that Trump can say, look, I will show up when 10,000 people are there, or I won't show up.
Mm-hmm.
And no one's going to say, well, you're an elitist. Well, yeah, of course he's an elitist. He's got a gold apartment. Yes, he's an elitist. Yes, he's actually, I mean, he's pretty much admitted that.
Yeah.
He's been like, I don't know why everyone says elitist is so bad. It sounds like a good thing to me. You know what I mean? Where Biden is doing the exact opposite pitch. Here's a guy who's got tons of money, tons of influence. Look at the shows. Go back and watch them. The Ukraine one is out there right now for free on YouTube at the Glenn Beck channel. Go there and watch what he's done in Ukraine, how much money flowed into that family. I mean, billions of dollars of deals were going through the company with his influence. They got plenty of money. They got plenty of influence. But he's trying to pitch himself as middle class Joe, which everyone calls him if everyone is Joe Biden. He calls himself middle class Joe. No one else calls him that. He's lunchbox Joe. He's the guy out. And I'm a union guy. I'm out there. He's basically acting like he's a construction worker running for president.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, that's not true at all. So he's A, having to lie about it. And B, like, you can't run the Trump style when I'm a guy who wants to shake everybody's hands because I've got my sleeves rolled up. Biden's style is not conducive to the Trump approach, and the Trump approach can be easier on a 70-plus-year-old person. So if he's sounding like this on day one, that is worrisome for me.
So let me ask you this. Because I saw some people on the left say, Trump took the bait. He's going after. He's making Joe Biden the candidate. Which is great for Joe Biden and great for the Democrats. And I thought, I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that Joe Biden is the end-all, be-all. I mean, who do you think would be the best candidate? I mean, of the ones who have a chance,
mm-hmm.
the best candidate to run against for Donald Trump?
Oh, if Donald Trump could pick his candidate?
If he could pick his candidate.
Elizabeth Warren. If he
okay,
could pick
one
his
that
candidate,
has a chance.
Well, she's in the top. She's in the second tier of candidates. I would say.
No, I mean
she's around 7%.
Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Joe Biden. you know, Pete Buttigieg, Bob Frank O'Rourke. I think he's tubing.
He is. He's tanking as we speak. I mean,
I think Bernie Sanders would be the best, would be the ideal choice.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Bernie Sanders, you know, the thing about Bernie Sanders is there is still a percentage of this country that remembers what socialism actually is, that it's not a social network. It's not how you interact at parties. It is something that killed 100 million people in the century that they lived in. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when you got a giant black book filled with 100 million dead bodies that are all responsible, that are all from communism and socialism, the older voter looks at that and says, even if they are friendly to the policies, the word is still scary enough to remember, wait a minute, this goes wrong. I like universal health care, but these things go that far and all of a sudden, whoa, where have we gone? Mm-hmm. And these things go down the hill fast. They remember this stuff.
Wait until you see the special. It's happening tomorrow night. It's free. You can go to blazetv.com/Glenn. You'll be able to watch it for free tomorrow, or you'll watch it on our YouTube channel or on our Facebook page. But watch it. Please watch it. Watch it with your friends. Watch it with your family. The special is called Socialism, A Warning from the Dead. And it's a live special event tomorrow at 8 p.m. And we made it free for the reason that we strongly believe every American needs to see this. This is a document based on a document that we found that was smuggled into the United States from behind the Iron Curtain in the 1960s. And it just disappeared. And nobody paid any attention to it. And you really need to. I was rereading it yesterday. And it is, I mean, it is torn right. When you hear it, the way it talks about democratic socialism and democracy, and we have to convince the people that they are in need of pure, direct democracy. And you see what people on the left are saying right now. It's the same thing. But this document shows you why they're saying these things. And it's a way to flip a country, and it was done by the former Soviet Union without a shot being fired. They flipped a massive free market to communism in 3 years, and we're already 3 years into this. Socialism, A Warning from the Dead. Make sure you watch it. It's, again, free tomorrow, a special event on our Facebook page, our YouTube page, and at blazetv.com/Glenn.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks. This is the scene from Valkyrie. Listen to this.
Hello, Christian.
Our men and the transport officers have secured the railway communications network, but there are repeater stations, telephone,
yes,
and
telegraph. My word.
Not just broadcast outposts. We need more men.
Give my best to your family. He's with us.
Birds, call POTS to tell them to place all available units under our control. You have your men, now get control of the radio.
We have control of the government quarter. We don't have Berlin yet.
This is what is happening right now in Venezuela. They're trying to get the broadcast. They're trying to get the government control. They're trying to convince the army to switch sides and go away from Maduro. Right now, it looks like the National Guard has taken at least one airbase. It's happening in multiple cities, but there hasn't been anything yet on broadcast. Broadcast is still saying, you know, this is a coup and it's being put down, but you have to remember, Maduro controls the broadcast. As soon as they get the broadcast facilities, that could accelerate things. If they don't get the broadcast facilities, it may die, and freedom may be lost again for another God only knows how long. We have Daniel DiMartino, who has an update on Venezuela in real time. Hi, Daniel. Tell us what's going on.
Hi, Glenn. So what happened was unexpectedly today, because tomorrow was supposed to be a big protest in Venezuela since it was May 1st, and that's what the president had said, Guaido. But Today we woke up to see a big chunk of the military uprising in Caracas, as well as in other parts of the country, with Guaido, and as well as former political prisoner, now free, Leopoldo López, who had been in jail for a long time, and now he's free. So we are very hopeful that this will mean that Maduro will be overthrown soon.
What are we looking for a sign that things are going either poorly or going well? Do you know, Daniel?
Yes. So I think that if this is successful, we'll see Maduro and the rest of his regime members fleeing the country, because that's what dictators do in these kinds of cases. Now, I'm still skeptical of, I don't want to say that it's, you know, successful when it's not, because we've had this type of operation happen before, Glenn. So we really have to be careful in what we say. We have to check what the information that President Guaido is showing. And as you said, especially to inform Venezuelans inside Venezuela, they have shut down most social media. YouTube is shut down. They're trying to shut down Twitter and Facebook. People are just communicating, sending videos through WhatsApp.
Mm. And we look for them to seize the banks and the gold. Do we know what the situation is in Venezuela about any remaining gold? I know he has shipped most of it out of the country to Turkey.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any gold left since they took it over a long time ago. But Venezuela won't need this gold, Glenn. We have a lot of natural resources. We have people who are willing to work. We just need the freedom to do it. You very well know that. Countries don't need natural resources even to succeed. They just need free markets. And hopefully this is what we'll get. I think that what the international community needs to be doing right now is supporting Guaido. They need to express their support and also stand ready to you know, actually take action if Guaido requests it. Because if this is not enough, as you said, it might be the last chance to get freedom in Venezuela. And there's a terrible humanitarian crisis, which, according to the UN, 7 million people are in risk of dying at any time if we don't get humanitarian aid in soon.
Unbelievable. Daniel, thank you so much. From Young Voices, that's Daniel DiMartino. And please keep us up to date, even as the show goes on today. We'd like to know. So you know, Mercury One has already stationed itself on the border. We have many of our allied groups there waiting to go in, waiting to provide aid. We just need the green light, and we could certainly use your support. If you would like to help those in Venezuela, if we can get in, as soon as this thing is over and we can get in, we're going in with soup kitchens ablazing, because we know how dire the situation is. We just can't get in at the moment, but we are stationed there. We are also stationed with the Nazarene Fund and Operation OUR right at the border as well, to try to find those children who have been taken from their parents and are being smuggled out across the border. We need your support. You can do that by going to mercuryone.org. That's mercuryone.org.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hey, it's Glenn, and I want to tell you about something that you should either end your day with or start your morning with, and that is The News and Why It Matters. If you like this show, you're going to love The News and Why It Matters. It's a bunch of us that all get together at the end of the day and just talk about the stories that matter to you and your life. The News and Why It Matters. Look for it now wherever you download your favorite podcast. And John Solomon is a journalist. He worked for the AP and the Washington Post, among others, for about 20 years. He now is the editor of, John, is it Politico or The Hill?
I'm executive vice president at The Hill.
Of The Hill. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no problem.
And executive vice president of The Hill. And John has been looking into the nefarious stuff that has been going on in Ukraine with really pretty much everybody, it seems, who's at the top of these parties. Joe Biden is one of them. And now, if we're looking for collusion, John, do you believe we found it in Ukraine with not the Trump administration, but the Obama administration?
We clearly have a growing body of evidence there, Glenn. And I think if we wind back a little bit, about a month ago, I reported that Ukrainian officials acknowledged that they had released a black ledger book during the 2016 election designed to tarnish Paul Manafort's reputation. And as part of that, they admitted that their goal was to help Hillary Clinton. And the evidence is pretty clear. There's a court ruling in Ukraine that says the Ukrainian government wrongly released this document in an effort to sway the 2016 election. And then there was a tape recording released by that court and by a parliamentary member that in which a top what you would call the FBI of Ukraine, it's called NABU. He was captured in a tape recording bragging that he was trying to help Hillary Clinton. So from that, we tried to roll back and find out, well, how did that happen? What was the genesis? What gave the idea of Ukraine to go look after or to release some dirt on Paul Manafort during the middle of the 2016 election, hoping to hurt Donald Trump and help Hillary Clinton? And what we found out was Ukraine officials were summoned to the Obama White House in January 2016. This is just as Donald Trump was beginning to rise in the polls and start to win his primary victories one after the other. And they brought these prosecutors together, including the very agency that leaked the documents, and gave them a mandate saying, hey, can you go out and help us find some dirt on Paul Manafort? And it was that meeting in January 2016 that gave rise to this sort of series of events where you have a foreign government now admitting on the record that it tried to intervene in the 2016 election. That government wasn't Russia. It was Ukraine.
That's unbelievable. Now, how much of this is related to what Joe Biden did with his son and holding back all of that American aid? I mean, was that involved at all? And I'm not saying that was part of the deal, just the flexing of the muscles that they knew if we don't help America out, they could cut us off at any time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's funny, both the Manafort case and the Biden case, what we call the Burisma case, both came up in that January meeting. And so the Democrats had two needs that they had from Ukraine. That's part of the reason why they took the extraordinary option of bringing them overseas, bringing them to the White House. Normally, prosecutors from a foreign government don't go to the White House. It's a rare episode to invite them into the White House and to have a discussion about what are really internal cases in Ukraine. The first one is Paul Manafort, as we just described. But the second one, according to the attendees at the meeting, the Obama White House also asked, could the Ukrainian authorities step down on their own investigation of a company called Burisma Holdings? Mm. This was the company that hired Hunter Biden, Joe Biden's son, to be a board member, and from which more than $3 million was paid in consulting fees to Hunter Biden during the 2014-2015 timeframe. So the second request at the meeting was, first, help us get dirt on Paul Manafort and Donald Trump. The second request was, could you guys stand down on the Burisma investigation? And if so, the FBI will take it over. Trust us. We'll do a good job investigating it. And that didn't happen. The Ukrainians wouldn't back down. So then 2 months later, what happened? Joe Biden shows up in Ukraine and says, if you don't fire the prosecutor leading that case, I'm going to cut off your foreign aid. And, of course, he got what he wanted. So that White House meeting had a dual purpose, according to the Ukrainians. One was Biden, one was Manafort.
So, John, what they were accusing Donald Trump of was accepting a phone call from the Russians saying, we have information. And the Trump, you know, campaign said, OK, we'll meet you. Let's talk about that. Then they had no information. This is much worse because it's the Obama White House reaching out to Ukraine and saying, we need your help to find dirt on these people.
That's exactly right. I mean, it's a
cow.
It's an overt ask as opposed to a passive receipt. So if you compare the two episodes, the Trump Tower meeting, it was sort of a passive event where the Russians take the initiative, ask to come in, then don't deliver the goods. Here you have the Obama administration making an overt request of the Ukrainians, and it's not the only one. If we remember, you go back to January 2017, so long ago now that we forgot this, but Politico reported that around the same time as this meeting that I just documented at the Obama White House, that the Democratic National Committee, in the form of one of its consultants, was seeking dirt from the Ukraine embassy. And I'm going to have some new revelations on that. But you have the DNC going into the Ukraine embassy in Washington, asking for dirt on Paul Manafort. You've got the White House asking Ukrainian authorities to help them restart the case on Paul Manafort. These are not accidents. They're not coincidences. There was a concerted effort by Democrats, both in the government and in the political party system, to try to get Ukraine's help in trying to make the case that Donald Trump was an agent of Russia, which we now know isn't true. And so now you have a foreign power involved, and you have pretty clear overt asks being made by Democrats of a foreign power to help them in the election.
Do we have anyone in journalism at all looking into this besides you?
The good news is I've heard from my friends in Ukraine that the Washington Post and the New York Times have been in country in the last few days asking questions. So hope springs eternal that more people will pay attention to this. I think as time goes on, the more important element to watch will be what Attorney General Barr does. He's taking a look at the entire intelligence community's behavior during the Russia investigation. And part of that could very well look at what was the source of this information? Who solicited it? Who was pushing the flesh on this? And I think when we get those answers, I think his inquiry almost certainly will lead in some directions towards Ukraine, because Ukraine was clearly playing in our election. They've admitted it now. And the question is, who was complicit? It's on the American side. And I think we're beginning to get a little bit of a portrait of who the conspirators or complicitous people were in the United States.
Okay, so, but the Ukraine did not like Manafort. I mean, they had nothing. They had no love lost for Manafort. Manafort was, I mean, he was a bad dude for Ukraine. He was on the right. He was corrupt, and he deserved what he got, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, he was helping the party that was the Russia-aligned party that got thrown out of power in 2014. He collected a lot of money. He's not the only one. Remember, Obama's White House counsel, Greg Craig, has been indicted for taking money from the same party, helping them, and then not properly accounting for it or reporting it here. Mm. So you had both Manafort and Greg Craig, a Republican and a Democrat, playing in this Ukraine field on behalf of the Russian-backed party, and the Ukrainians didn't like either. What's interesting, if you read my story, you'll find out that when the Ukrainians said, hey, we not only have stuff on Manafort, we have stuff on Greg Craig, and the Democratic administration said, oh, no, we're not interested in that. Just keep that to yourself. And so you can kind of see the selective nature of what went on between the U.S. government and the Ukrainian prosecutors.
So off the subject, what is your take of what's just happened with this new president who's a comedian? Any gauge on him, on where he's going to fall on things?
Well, there are some. So his name is Zelensky. He's a first-time political newcomer, was the most famous comic on Ukraine television. He was sort of we would consider Jerry Seinfeld in the 90s to Ukraine. Mm-hmm. He's now the president-elect, will be president shortly. And he has made quite a few soundings in the last few weeks that he wants to get to the bottom of this. He wants Ukraine to get clean on this. I think you're going to see a change in leadership in all the offices, including the prosecutor's office. One person that there's a lot of speculation in Ukraine about becoming the next attorney general, the next prosecutor general, is a guy named Kulik. And Kulik is one of the people I've talked to several times on the record who has kind of told the story that the Ukrainians were playing in the election, that we got cut off in the investigation of Biden. If he becomes the next prosecutor general, the American administration will have a very strong counterpart if they so choose to investigate these allegations.
Wow. Thank you so much for doing all this work, John. Appreciate it. John Solomon, he's the executive vice president of The Hill and a journalist, even though the left is trying to discredit him, saying, no, he's an opinion guy. Really, 20 years AP and Washington Post, that makes you an opinion guy? He's tracking down the facts without the opinion. And the left just doesn't like what he finds.
This is the best of the Glenn Beck program.
You know, the New York Times had a headline recently. It was in March. I'm sorry, it wasn't New York Times. It was Politico. And in the article, the headline was "How Bernie Could Save Socialism from Trump," making Donald Trump the enemy of socialism. Amen. Good. Well, you've got my vote. The headline turned out to be the tamest part of the article. Listen to this. Sanders should deliver a detailed speech that chronicles exactly where Maduro went wrong and why he doesn't deserve the moniker of socialist. This is such revisionist history, which Stu is going to get into here in just a second. Such revisionist history. Chavez already, when he left office, Venezuela was already number one on the misery index in the world. Okay? It was already falling apart. This is what always happens with socialist countries. Remember, we're not talking about Canada or Sweden. Those are free markets with socialist underpinnings. So in other words, you know, socialist medicine. But that's not a socialist country. It's a free market. Venezuela is a socialist country. The government controls everything. This is exactly what democratic socialists are looking for. And we have to be really, really clear on this. When they're saying he's not a socialist, he's a dictator. Yes, that's what happens. Well, that's what Hitler. Hitler wasn't socialist because he just took power. No, he was democratically elected. He even gave the people a chance. He then broke the Constitution by killing so many people in the Night of Long Knives. But he went to the president, and the president forgave him, and the people forgave him. Then he took power. He became a chancellor. Well, he still was a socialist. He just became a dictator. Venezuela is a socialist country. But once these guys start to lose power, then they don't care about the democratic process anymore. A few days ago, the New York Times ran another article. This one was, "Can we please relax about socialism?" No, I don't think we should. Only in America is the word used with such perceived menace. Now, check out this definition of democratic socialism. Democratic socialism is, briefly put, a noble tradition of civic consciousness that was historically a far greater degree than any of its champions or detractors today often care to acknowledge, grounded in deep Christian roots. Really? Really? I mean, that's an argument I haven't heard before. It's ridiculous, and the author never explains it, but it sure sounds nice. Then we get this. In countries where, since World War II, the principles of democratic socialism have shaped public policy, basically everywhere in the developed world except here, the lives of the vast majority of citizens, most especially in regards to affordable health care, have improved enormously. Well, it turns out the New York Times specializes in commentary about socialism. In March, the article "Bernie Sanders Scares a Lot of People, and Quite a Few People of Them Are Democrats" captures the angst that democratic socialists are causing. Here's, listen to this, a word of caution from the New York Times. The United States was founded as a contradiction to, not an extension of, Europe. Self-reliance is to America what fraternity is to France, part of its core. The American space, so immense, so un-European, conjures in Americans a bristling independence of spirit that wants government out of their lives. But other than that, it checks all the socialist boxes. Socialism is not journalist, it says. Intellectuals or politicians armed with a policy agenda. As Marx and Engels understood, this was one of their core insights. What distinguished them from other socialist thinkers ever ready with their blueprints is the workers who get us there, who decide what and where there is. That, too, is a kind of freedom, a socialist freedom. Now, here's the lie, and here's the thing I'm going to give to you tomorrow on a special broadcast that we have made for free. I don't remember a broadcast we have worked this hard on for this long.
Especially when you're giving away. Good job.
Yeah, I know.
Smart.
I had a fight to make this one free. They don't like giving especially this has been wildly expensive. but I want it to go out to the widest possible audience, and I need you to watch it and to share it. So you can watch it on blazetv.com. You can also see it on our Facebook page and also on our YouTube page tomorrow live at 8 p.m. Eastern. Please, please share this with a friend. It is all about socialism and a warning that we have found from the dead now. This is a plan, a blueprint. And as the New York Times said, it's not, socialism is not journalists, intellectuals, or politicians armed with a policy agenda. It's the people. But in the intellectual's blueprint, it describes this. And it talks about how you have to have democracy to get there. Now listen, in order that the reformist democratic way to socialism be complete, there had to be, of course, a denial of the basic condition of the possibility of victory for socialism, of the dictatorship. Our state has decided for socialization in the democratic manner, that is to say, at the ballot and not through revolution or dictatorship, thus solving the problems of transition from capitalism to socialism, breaking the desperate resistance of the bourgeoisie of expropriating the desperate resistance of the capitalists. Private capitalist production into socialist production on a large scale should be possible without the direction of policy by the workers' class, without a dictatorship. Just by phrases about some sort of pure democracy. In other words, revision and denial of the basic Marxism of Marxist-Leninist theory of classes and class struggle. So they're saying, look, if we want to do this without revolution, what we have to do is convince the average person that you need pure democracy, because people will vote for free stuff. So if we can get pure democracy, we can do it without a strong arm of revolution or a dictatorship. Then once we have it, as it goes on, then the vice comes down. Then we have it and we hold them. This is how they flipped other countries. The blueprint that we're going to show you tomorrow was one that was smuggled in from behind the Iron Curtain into the United States in the 1960s. And then it was just lost and people forgot it. And I'm not saying anybody is using this as their blueprint. I'm just saying we're getting to exactly the same place. They're doing exactly the same thing as this blueprint written in 1950 and used on Czechoslovakia. They're using the same tactics. So whether they know it or not, it doesn't matter. They flipped Czechoslovakia. They're flipping us. And you need to see it. You need to watch it with an open mind. That's tomorrow at 8 p.m. Eastern. The kind of stuff that nobody in the mainstream media is going to actually do their homework. It's not conspiracy theories. It is the truth. And I make that case tomorrow at 8 p.m. Don't miss it. Socialism, a warning from the dead.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
There is something really disturbing going on in America. Truly, truly disturbing. And it has reared its ugly head here before, and it always happens during a time where there's a rise in socialism. And it is worse in Europe, but it is becoming very clear here. Even the New York Times last week, I don't want to show you this if you happen to be watching Blaze TV, but the New York Times op-ed cartoon up with Donald Trump being led by a dog with the face of Benjamin Netanyahu by a leash. And he's wearing dark sunglasses, and it looks like he is leading, you know, being led by Israel. The dog has a Jewish Star of David around its neck. It is horrifying. And the New York Times said, oh, we apologize for that. We apologize. Really? You didn't know that was anti-Semitic? Well, it kind of looks like something that maybe Germany... No, it doesn't kind of look. It looks exactly like what Germany did. In fact, we found a magazine cover from Germany with an old Jew leading by the hand Winston Churchill. It's exactly what Goebbels was doing. And the left seems to not care about it. And we have to care about the people that are in China, the Muslims that are in China, that are being rounded up systematically and killed or tortured in China. We have to care about the Christians that are being killed and bombed. And we also have to care about our Jewish brothers and sisters. And I was so moved by what happened in California that the rabbi said to one congregant, could you bring your gun? Because he worked for the border security. Could you bring your gun? So this guy would travel 4 hours back and forth just to be able to be at the synagogue and worship. He happened to be there with his gun, and he's the reason that that didn't become a mass shooting. These synagogues and these houses of worship and the Torah schools are under attack. And could you survive? Could your church survive if it had to have bomb-proof, bulletproof glass? I mean, think of the cost. Well, I got an email on Sunday from Yael Eckstein, and Yael she's with the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews. Her father was the rabbi that ran that for a very, very long time, who has just passed away. And the last time I saw him, we talked about how can we help these synagogues that are under attack. And so Yael is with us now. Hi, Yael. How are you?
Hi, Glenn. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. First of all, I'm so sorry about the passing of your dad. He was a great, great man.
Thank you. I know he felt the same way about you.
Thank you. So we see in France a 74% increase in the number of attacks against Jews. Germany, 60%. Here in the U.S., last year alone, it's up 57% here in the United States. And I don't know how these synagogues can afford to harden themselves.
It is a huge problem that we're seeing all around the world, that Jews are vulnerable. I mean, you see the attacks in Europe have become a daily occurrence. And now that it's gotten to America with San Diego and the Tree of Life Synagogue, where 11 people were killed, if it could happen in America, it's a sign that it's happening even more intense in the Arab world and across Europe. And so what we've been so shocked by, these attacks that we just would never believe could happen on American soil, at synagogues during worship, at churches, at mosques, like what we're seeing around the world. It's always been the case, Glenn, that when the world has gone crazy and can no longer distinguish between good and bad and right and wrong and darkness and light, it's the Jews who are targeted. Mm-hmm. And right now we're in a world where there is so much darkness. And what we're seeing is that the Jews more and more every single day are being targeted. And so just like you said, you spoke about with my father came back from that meeting so encouraged that, you know, the fellowship's donors are mostly individuals who give $50 a month, the widow's mite, and their tithes from Social Security to help Israel and the Jewish people. And I remember him coming back from that meeting with you and saying, it's not just the individuals who care so much about Israel and the Jewish people and about Christians who are being persecuted across the Middle East and about Muslims who are being targeted. It's people on the top as well, like Glenn Beck. So thank you for standing for these important issues. And I know your followers feel the same and appreciate that in you.
So here's what I would like to suggest. And your father and I talked about this, and I know you have developed a fund. But I would like to suggest that if you would like to help support and protect the Jewish people, this is the first step to being, you know, one of the righteous, is taking an active step to protect the Jewish people. And you can do that by donating. And you've set up a page. Why don't you tell me about the page and where the money will go for security?
Yeah, so the fellowship, Jewish communities around the world rely on the fellowship to provide them with simple things that you would never believe that they don't have, like security doors or a security camera or a lock on the door. And it's all for Jewish synagogues and schools in locations that we work with different officials that I can't speak about, but that they know the exact Jewish communities are most at risk and being targeted directly by terror groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda. That just last year we equipped places like Norway, Oslo, in India, in France, in Mexico, in Thailand. And so now what we're working on is to get security for locations that we know they are being targeted. And there are many of those places like Poland and Turkey and Russia. And so our goal is to raise $500,000 now to immediately equip the most, I'd say the most targeted 8 locations across the world that we know there are direct threats against them. And what they need are simple security precautions like anti-bullet windows or a security guard to simply stand at their gate, make sure a terrorist doesn't come in with a gun. And so the way that your audience can donate is we set up a special number because we know that your followers are just so so generous and so forthcoming in doing the right thing to help others in situations of crisis like the Jewish communities around the world is in right now. And so we have a special number. It's 1-800-201-8383. Once again, that's 1-800-201-8383. Or online, www.ifcj.org/Beck. And yes, something like a camera system that places like America, almost every synagogue has, and these attacks still happen. Well, in places like Kathmandu, Nepal, they don't have that, and they're in need of that.
Yael, thank you so much. And we will encourage our listeners to help out. And thank you so much. Just let us know how we can help and what we can do.
Thank you so much.
God bless.
And I just join you in praying for peace and doing everything we can to bring hope to those people who need it. God bless you, Glenn.
Thank you. Yael Eckstein, she is with the International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, the IFCJ.org/Beck is where you can donate, or you can call the number that she laid out. It's 800-201-8383. This, honestly, you know, I'm doing something on socialism tomorrow. And my daughter came in and she brought something that I got for her birthday a few years ago. This is my eldest daughter, Mary. And it's a picture of the woman I always talk about, Paulina, that was one of the righteous among the nations. And it's the only picture. She would only let us take a picture of her hands. And we got one picture of her. And that one picture is of her side. She was so shy and so sweet. And she just didn't want any credit. She was just somebody who tried to do the right thing and try to reach out and save the Jewish people that she could save. And at the very bottom of that is the quote that she told me. The righteous did not suddenly become righteous. They just did not go over the cliff with the rest of society. All we have to do is do what we've always done. When people are in need, we act. There is nothing that will give us more protection than helping children. And quite honestly, I think helping the Lord's people. It's clearly in the scriptures. They are targeted. Christians are being targeted. And you know what we're doing with the Nazarene Fund. And I urge you to get involved if you'd like to get involved in that. But here is something where these people are going into the synagogue, or they're sending their kids to school, and they are terrified. So let's help the eight or nine different facilities around the world that are most in danger. And you can donate now at ifcj.org/Beck or call 800-201-8383.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.